So I'm going to today talk about the HPV Impact Project, which is a project that CDC has been conducting in collaboration with colleagues in the Emerging Infections Program Network to monitor the impact of HPV vaccine on cervical cancer precursors. So just as a brief background, genital human papillomavirus, or HPV, is a very common sexually transmitted infection. There are over 40 genital HPV types, and most sexually active adults will have been exposed to one or more. One or more of these types in their lifetime. The majority of infections resolve spontaneously without producing any disease within a year or two, but some infections can persist, and infections with certain high-risk types can cause anogenital and oropharyngeal cancers. Cervical cancer accounts for the largest fraction of all the HPV-related cancers, and of all the high-risk types, HPV types 16 and 18 are responsible for 70% of all the cervical cancers. There are also low-risk type HPVs that are not oncogenic, but they cause anogenital warts and recurrent respiratory papillomatosis. And about over 90% of the genital warts are caused by two HPV types 6 and 11. There are now two prophylactic HPV vaccines that have been licensed in the U.S. There's the quadrivalent vaccine against types 6, 11, 16, and 18, which was licensed in 2006. And a bivalent vaccine against types 16 and 18, which was more recently licensed late last year. Either vaccine is recommended by the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, or ACIP, for routine use in girls 11 and 12 years and catch-up vaccine through age 26. Both vaccines have been shown to be highly efficacious against vaccine-type infection and associated endpoints in the clinical trials of vaccine efficacy. Now that the vaccines are in widespread usage, the next thing to do is to evaluate the effectiveness of these vaccines in reducing the burden of HPV-related disease in a real-world setting. And cervical cancer is the most important outcome because it represents the biggest burden of HPV-related disease, and it's in fact being monitored through established cancer registries that cover most of the U.S. population. The problem is that cervical cancer takes decades to develop and so is not a very timely measure of vaccine impact. But cervical cancer is a multi-step process, and along the way, cervical lesions develop much earlier than invasive cancer, and they can be used as intermediate endpoints to measure vaccine impact on cervical disease. And these cervical lesions include cervical intraepithelial neoplasia, or CIN, which is graded from 1 to 3, depending on the severity of the lesion, and adenocarcinoma in situ, or AIS, which is a relatively rare outcome. CIN grades 2 and higher, and AIS were actually used as surrogate endpoints for cervical cancer in all the vaccine trials. So just a little bit about CIN and its diagnosis. CIN actually represents a spectrum of abnormal changes in the cervix. And importantly, CIN lesions are completely asymptomatic, and they're only detected through routine cervical cancer screening. And typically what happens is a woman goes in for a routine pap smear, and if that pap smear is abnormal, then she is referred to have a procedure called a colposcopy to get a better examination of the cervix through a microscope. And if a lesion is detected at that point, a biopsy is taken and the tissue is sent to a pathologist for histopathologic review. And it's at that point that CIN and AIS are diagnosed. So CIN is graded based on the thickness of the abnormality in the intraepithelial layer of the cervix. And so in this cartoon, you see on the far left what normal cells are supposed to look like histologically. And in the section to the right, you start to see some abnormal changes that are fairly mild. This is considered CIN grade 1. And most of these lesions, they are associated with HPV. They're caused by HPV, but they do regress spontaneously usually and don't require any kind of treatment. The section next to that is CIN grade 2, and what happens here is you get more abnormal cells in the epithelial layer. As you can see, about two-thirds of the layer is supposed to be abnormal to be called grade 2, and grade 2 is actually a mixture of HPV lesions that will regress, but also precancerous lesions that may progress to cervical cancer if left untreated. And there's a lot of variability in diagnosis because the interpretation of the grade and distinguishment from grade 1 and grade 3 is difficult to make. The last grade is CIN grade 3, which is also called carcinoma in situ, and this is the true precancerous lesion. And it has very good reproducibility diagnostically. And if left untreated, this will probably invade the basement membrane and become invasive squamous cell carcinoma. CIN is not reported nationally in the US, and so there's no monitoring system at the national level. Recently, CIN grade 2 and higher has become reportable in some states, including New Mexico, Florida, Connecticut, and Tennessee. And CIN3 is also being reported to some state cancer registries, including Michigan, Kentucky, and Louisiana, and most recently, Los Angeles County, which has its own cancer registry, has begun collecting CIN3. So we'll be able to look at some trends in CIN and diagnosis over time in these states. Well, the objective of our project, the HPV Impact Project, was to evaluate the population-based impact of HPV vaccine on cervical disease in a much more detailed way than would be possible on the state level. And so what we had to do first was to establish a system for CIN23 and AIS case reporting. And so we wanted to do active laboratory-based surveillance in very well-defined geographic catchments. And another objective that we have is, because these lesions are only detected through screening, we wanted to determine cervical cancer screening rates in these catchments in order to look at the incidence of disease in women screened over time to adjust for any changes in screening and any differences in screening across the different catchments. Another thing we plan to do with this project is to collect specimens, diagnostic specimens, and do HPV DNA typing on them, because only 50% of these CIN23 lesions are associated with HPV, and so if we can look at type-specific lesions over time, it's gonna allow us a more timely and accurate measure of vaccine impact. Finally, we want to be able to collect vaccine status on the cases so that we can compare CIN rates among the vaccinated and the unvaccinated over time, and other relevant demographic and clinical information to look at disparities and subgroups and variation by key demographic characteristics. So we have, we're piloting the project in five sites currently, and from the top right, they are Monroe County in upstate New York, New Haven County in Connecticut, Davidson County in Tennessee, which includes the state capital, Nashville. And on the West Coast, we have a portion of Alameda County, which is east of San Francisco, and the Portland metro area in Oregon. And Oregon actually joined this project about a year after the other sites did. So we started setting up this system in 2007, and by the end of 2007, we were successful in establishing the surveillance system, and that entailed identifying all the pathology labs that served the population, the female population in the catchment, and recruiting them to participate in this project, often without any mandate and little to no funding. So this was a huge undertaking. And we've been very successful in doing that. And so we started collecting data in 2008, and So far, we have complete reporting in 3 sites, Connecticut, New York, and California, and Tennessee and Oregon are still collecting 2008 data. So I'm going to show you some very preliminary results of the CIN23 surveillance and for 2008, and also mention some of the challenges in developing the system. Of note, there are a lot of additional activities, including the specimen collection and the vaccine history and other data that's being collected. I'm not going to talk about that today. The results are not quite ready for prime time yet. Okay, so to date, we've had a total of a little over 2,200 cases reported across the 5 sites. Connecticut, New York, and California are not expecting to get any more reports, but as I said, Tennessee and Oregon are still collecting data for 2008. So among the sites that have complete reporting, about half of the cases were CIN2, and 20% of the diagnoses were CIN2/3, which means that the pathologist either couldn't distinguish the grade between 2 and 3 or didn't distinguish the grade because it has no clinical relevance because grade 2 and 3 are managed the same, so often pathologists don't make the distinction. 30% were grade 3, and only 2% overall were either AIS or AIS in combination with CIN. So this graph shows you the age frequency distribution of just the CIN cases. This is not including the AIS, by grade of CIN in the 3 areas with complete reporting for 2008. So as you can see, the majority of the cases are under 30 years old, and the highest burden is in the 18 to 24 year olds. And in that group, CIN2 is a higher proportion of the total cases than in the older age groups. And as you recall, CIN2 is more likely to regress than CIN3. One thing we wanted to do at the outset was to get an idea of how many cases to expect and the incidence rates that we would expect in these areas. And so we took the only available data on CIN rates in the US that was based on a study that was done in 1998 in a group of women that were enrolled in a large health maintenance organization. And so we took age-specific rates from that study and US census data, and we estimated the incidence rates for the sites. And it was roughly about 200 per 100,000. There's a little bit of variability because there's different age distributions in the sites, but that's what we were expecting to get in the sites. What we're finding is different than what we expected. So in Connecticut and New York, we have higher incidence rates than what we thought we would get, about 15 or 20% higher in those sites, whereas in California we have much lower rates than expected. And we aren't really sure why we're seeing these differences, but we're investigating that currently, and in particular we're going to be looking at differences in cervical cancer screening and also making sure that we're getting complete reporting. So in order to understand some of these rate differences, we have to address a number of different challenges. And as far as case reporting, we have to make sure that we haven't missed any labs that serve the catchment area, and also make sure that all the labs that have been identified are participating. Another challenge that we have in terms of case reporting is trying to streamline the reporting, and ultimately what we'd like to do is to have standardized electronic reporting, but we have a long way to go for that yet. And case ascertainment is also a big challenge with CIN because of the variation in the diagnosis, especially in CIN2 diagnosis. Also, pathologists use inconsistent terminology often. CIN is a relatively new terminology for these lesions, and so pathologists tend to use the old terminology or a combination of the new and the old, or terminology that really should be used for cytology. And so there's a lot of variability in the terminology that's used. And what's even worse is there's no standard coding for these diagnoses. And so some labs use ICD-9 codes, some labs use SNOMED codes, and other labs use their own in-house coding system. So another big challenge is that cervical cancer screening utilization is really difficult to ascertain. There's no screening registries, and the aggregate data on number of women screened are not readily available from the labs. And so just quickly, we've come a long way. We've made great strides, but this is a work in progress, and we've got a long way to go. And so our next steps are to investigate the variability in CIN2-3 rates, develop methods to estimate cervical screening in the catchment, look at our numerator more closely, make sure we've identified the labs that serve the catchment, evaluate the case ascertainment methods, determine the HPV type distribution in the lesions, and collect vaccine status and other relevant information, possibly through special studies, and continue monitoring for the next 10 years. Thank you. More cases
of dysplasia of CIN2-3, say in the 49 age bracket.
Right. So this age distribution is actually consistent with HPV infection. HPV infection is much higher in younger ages, and these lesions, especially the ones in yellow, the CIN2s, tend to regress. A lot of them will actually regress spontaneously, and so it's not really surprising to see more CIN2 in the younger age group who has been exposed to or been infected with HPV sooner than the older ages. So it's not counterintuitive to see this distribution.
And also screening and treatment.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yes. So this project is specifically designed to measure vaccine impact on cervical precancers. But there are a lot of HPV-based technology and methods that are being developed for cervical cancer screening that will probably change screening practices and screening recommendations. The HPV tests will allow longer intervals between screening, for example. But we're not really, that's not what we're looking at. We want to measure vaccine impact, and we want to adjust for any changes that are due to changes in screening.
So what do you think would impact the frequency of Pap smears? Only this year the recommendation came that women should be Pap every 2 to 3 years. Do you think of that?
We're not going to make any recommendations. All we want to do is measure reductions in 16-18 related lesions. And again, it's to measure impact of vaccine on cervical disease, on early cervical disease. So we're not, you know, this study is really not meant to make any recommendations on screening.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.